Hi folks, John here. What you're about to listen to is a quick chat that Helen, Jeremy, and I had about the recent developments in Syria. It's about a week since Assad fled Damascus, and we thought we'd just take stock of what's happened since then and what the regional ramifications are shaping up to look like. There's a lot of unanswered questions, but hopefully you find this conversation insightful and engaging. Don't hesitate to let us know by shooting us an email, and we'll try to do more of these rapid react kind of podcasts in the future. Okay, let's get on with it. I mean, truly, you two are experts. You appeared on Mark Halperin's two-way show earlier this week. I also appeared, but kind of sat there smiling.
Looking pretty.
Exactly.
You've got good hair.
Yeah, that's great. As is my role. That is true. Yeah.
But I was genuinely so impressed. I know you guys very well, and I was still so impressed with how you handled the Syria questions. And this was when it was still going on. So I thought, you know, we should do that again. In the week, as I said, in the week since Assad fled, like a fill in the dots, Israel has moved in to parts of Syria and is occupying parts. Helen will probably talk about that, but it's still there on Syrian territory, and it's said it will stay there until a new force fills the vacuum in Syria. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in Jordan right now, or was in Jordan today, for talks with the Jordanian administration and the king there. And a top Turkish official apparently is in Damascus today as well. So there's a lot of regional maneuvering, a lot of diplomacy going on, as we might expect. I mean, the government, or the assumed government, the sort of rebel force that was so successful in taking Damascus, HTS, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, is that roughly
great the pronunciation there, John? How long did you spend on that?
I've spent all day. Well, since I've been offline.
He's done deep now, really.
Deep work in my calendar, I think it's called. they're still a terrorist group by the international community. Still designate them a terrorist group. The leader, Jolani, has still got a $10 million bounty on his head from the US government, which is kind of wild because he's potentially going to be the new leader of Syria and meeting with these folks. So with that, JD, Jeremy, that's your nickname for folks who don't know that. JD, do you want to just give us any more details on what you've seen over this week, where we're at? I mean, any major things that have happened since we wrote about this on Monday? What's the situation? Is Damascus back and thriving? Is it back to being a normal city, or is it still where we're at?
When can John go jet skiing there, I think is what he's asking.
I really want to go to Damascus. Continually habited capital in the world. I really want to go, and it's very selfish of Assad to blow it to school.
Well,
and ISIS.
For a lot of our like post university life, it's kind of been off limits, right? Mm-hmm. Like friends of ours, I won't say their last names, but like former colleagues Ryan and Ben, they were backpacking through Syria when the protests started, and they were, you know, they said it was an amazing place to visit, friendly people, and then they're like, oh, you know, that looks a little spicy, that huge gathering of people yelling angrily over there. And then, Assad overreacted more than that, brutally crushed it down and tilted his country into civil war. It's meant to be a great place, right? And Helen, you mentioned the other day, that's where we used to do our Arabic training.
That's right. Not just us, but a lot of kind of Western countries used to send the diplomats for a safe and sort of, you know, beautifully sounding Levant Arabic, as opposed to sending them to Jordan or to Egypt.
Egyptian Arabic is kind of fairly different to the classical Arabic, isn't it? Or they speak that, but they also speak an Egyptian version of Arabic.
Yeah, that's right. So if you want to get the right accent, they used to send them to Damascus.
There you go.
Anyway, there you go. Well, look, you mentioned, Helen, the word Levant. That's actually what HTS stands for, the Committee for the Liberation of the Levant, which is
there you go.
A very dull, I guess one interesting thing about that name is it's not an Islamist name. It's a sort of nationalist, you know, local focused mission. We're not trying to defeat the great Satan. We're not trying to, convert entire regions or continents to our religion. We're just trying to liberate this one spot. And I guess that gets down to the crux of where we're at, which is the whole world kind of waiting to see really who is this HTS. They kind of came out of nowhere a couple of weeks ago. I mean, people who've been watching knew who they were because they've been engaged in a pretty fascinating government experiment up in this sort of northern stronghold of Idlib for the last few years, kind of establishing this Islamist technocratic government there called the Salvation Government. It sounds fascinating. They, whilst being a listed terrorist organization and whilst having a $10 million bounty on his head, they've established a pretty high-functioning, non-internationally recognized administration, but there's a UN office there in Idlib dealing with NGOs, aid, managing a border crossing with Turkey. One of the interesting things I heard was they have got a lot of their government services online, so you can get a driver's license or ID in 5 minutes. Whereas
quicker than DC, really.
And under Assad, you would have to wait months and then pay a bribe to get one at all. Ditto the, you know, the Financial Times sent journalists in and they got their media accreditation within 15 minutes, again, online. Whereas, you know, Assad, that just stopped happening for you. So it's this really strange world that we're entering when we're getting to know again both Jilani and his HTS.
It's interesting.
And the big question is, who are they? Who are they really?
Well, yeah, exactly. And that's interesting to me, because that clearly shows that they placed some importance on legitimacy and governing and being seen as the kind of controlling authority of Idlib. And it was important to them to kind of, you know, make systems work. I know they were providing some public services and stuff, whereas that's never been the case with some of the more like, I mean, because they are a descendant or at least kind of in a lineage from Al-Qaeda, right? They came from, and they've arguably moderated since then. But clearly that shows that they care about governance, not just destroying things and kind of establishing caliphates and all that kind of stuff. They care about governance. And I will come to this a bit later, but you know, Turkey, I think, has been pretty instrumental in helping them govern in Idlib, you know, letting a lot of supplies through the border. I think there's Turkish troops in Idlib. Turkey, you know, who nominates that group as a terrorist organization is also working with them at the same time. But we'll come to that later. Helen, do you have anything to note about that? Because I think it's fascinating to like kind of see this weird militia group actually being like, oh, we're going to try and govern a small area of Syria.
Yeah, I mean, I think the key thing to keep in mind is that they've kind of been cooking for kind of 10 years, right? The Syrian civil war has gone on for, as Jeremy said, the majority of our sort of formative years post-university. And they have actually been 10 years ago, or almost 10 years ago in 2015, they were very close to taking Damascus. Not them specifically, but the sort of other constellations of the rebel forces that were at Damascus knocking at the door until the Russians came in. Right. And I think one thing to kind of keep in mind is how we got here. Right. What happened to Assad? How did he fall so quickly? I mean, part of it is just that, you know, the Iranians were supporting him, and with the sort of kneecapping, if you will, of Hezbollah and sort of Iranian Shiite proxies across the region by Israel, and then the Russians being completely distracted in Ukraine, it kind of left them this golden opportunity, the rebels, as in, to come into Damascus and sort of take over the regime. So I think that's one thing that I think has been really interesting. And in some ways, for those who have been watching for a long time, like I have, it's a no-brainer that this has happened if you sort of think about all the different moving parts and the results of, you know, the cause and effect of life and world events.
Did either of you, being honest, and I'm, you can't do an Ian Bremmer here and say one thing and then delete your post and say you never said it. Did either of you, A, was Syria on your radar 3 weeks ago as a thing to be like, oh, this is something to watch? And B, would you ever have expected it to happen so quickly?
Okay, I have this on record, and I did write about this in our intros, right, the day before I think something did happen in Syria. And it wasn't because I was necessarily watching it closely, but I just remember we were thinking about the Middle East and how quickly things changed there. And I sort of cast my mind back to Syria and sort of how quickly things swung, or the pendulum swung very quickly there. But that was the extent of it. I thought that, you know, the Syrian rebels were now going to, you know, be kind of pocketed into their corner of Syria, and Assad was kind of there to stay because he'd been welcomed into the Gulf states recently, a few months ago anyway. And
yeah,
you know,
Assad's made a big effort at kind of like saying hello and bringing him back into the, not the international community, but at least the Gulf and Arab community, right?
Exactly. So I was wrong. I was Ian Bremmer there.
JD.
Well, yeah, we should outline that. Yeah, Ian Bremmer is this sort of celebrity geopolitical pundit.
He's catching strays from me. I'm sorry about that.
Well, but the funny thing was, like, hours after HTS had taken Damascus and shocked the world. A tweet appeared from Project Syndicate, which is a really highly regarded kind of, more of a think tank nerdy outlet. And it had this publishing an article like that moment explain, and it was Ian Bremmer, a guest article, Ian Bremmer explaining how it was very unlikely the rebels would be able to, you know, penetrate the Assad stronghold and topple the regime. Because Iran and Russia needed him so much. But to answer your question, John, you know, did any of us expect this? No. I guess the one thing I would say is that, you know, we've dealt with a guy called Charles Lister before, who's one of the top Western experts on Syria. He's been working on Syria for 14 years. He's gone there, met HTS, done field work, like has deep, deep contacts. He's based in DC. He was tweeting as far back as September that there seemed to be a renewed rebel push in the works. So he could feel something coming, but even he was shocked. And to be honest, even HTS were shocked that they gave this thing a nudge. And I think Turkish intelligence people were telling that, Turkish intelligence were telling media that they had quietly given the green light. They thought it was going to be a limited counteroffensive just to push the Syrian airstrikes back because they were kind of, you know, doing damage in civilian areas around Idlib and whatnot. They thought it was going to be this limited, just push back, go away, leave us alone. And then they're like, whoops, we just took Aleppo. And then that just changed everything. So, I think if the people themselves were surprised, you can't blame Ian Bremmer for being surprised either. HTS didn't delete their tweets about it, though.
I think that he's had a history of this, right? There was also a track record of him, or was it someone else? Maybe it was Jake Sullivan who had posted about the Israel and looking stronger than ever before October 7th happened.
The region looking more peaceful.
Do you remember that? Yeah, that's right. More peaceful and stable than ever.
Yeah.
We've all been there. It's okay.
I mean, being wrong isn't the problem. This stuff is fundamentally unknowable. It's the declarative statements and then the lack of accountability. But we digress. This is not a roast. I agree with both of you. I mean, I think with hindsight, though, I'm kind of a bit surprised that folks who like Charles Lister and folks who live and breathe this stuff weren't more on top of it. That's an unfair word. Just more kind of like, hey guys, I think something's here. Because if you think about it with hindsight, it's like, well, we knew that Assad was propped up by Hezbollah. We knew that he was propped up by, and I think more importantly, propped up by Russian air power.
Yeah.
Because that's what really makes it implausible for rebels to take towns when you're just getting absolutely pounded from the air day in, day out by modern air forces. But Hezbollah being, you know, gutted, it probably should have been a little bit more, at least on our radar, that this could happen. And I think one of the things that is unknowable but could have been a fairly reasonable assumption too is that when those rebels started that push, that Syrian army, the Assad's army, was going to bail because it's just so corrupt. It's just been so corrupt for so long. It's rotten to its core. And we have so much history of that, right? So many this is the Iraqi army in the Gulf War that kind of really didn't put up a fight because, you know, it was disorganized. There wasn't funding. It was all
demoralized.
Corrupt. Demoralized. What the hell are we fighting for? You know, all that
exactly.
Kind of stuff. So, and you know, it seems to be the way too that when these things get going in the last, you know, recent history, I'm going to have to go back to look at the US withdrawal from Afghanistan, where everyone goes, oh my God, they did it in 4 days or 6 days or whatever it is, sweeping through a country because people aren't just not willing to fight anymore if they feel like they're losing.
Yeah. What's the most surprising thing, I think, is that Russia kind of just backed out, right? I think that calculation of all of these strategic calculations for me was most surprising.
And that's the Ukraine side, right?
And that's the Ukraine side. But you think about what Russia loses from this. They lose Latakia and Tartus, right? They've got an air base in Latakia and then a warm water port in Tartus, which is something that they desperately needed for their naval operations in Africa and sort of Mediterranean rim. And so what is the onflowing, you know, impact of that in the region and their operations there? That's what I'm watching.
That's a great time, I think, to pivot, because I wanted to talk about sort of there's a political vacuum now. You know, 2 weeks ago we had a central government such as it was propped up by Russia and Iran. Now we have HTS, we have some other opposition groups in the south, we have a US base in the south, the eastish area, I guess.
Yeah, we have ISIS there too.
You have ISIS, and then you have that huge Kurdish area in the north east. Mm-hmm. And then obviously Turkey on the northern border, and Lebanon and Israel. So there are, I mean, it's, again, I made this point a few times. It's hard to think of more cooks in the kitchen than when it comes to Syria. What do you think is going to happen? Is HTS going to be able to form a centralized government to kind of be? Because I think that's the thing, right? Like, yeah, everyone is worried that there's going to be they're going to fall back into civil war, that ISIS is going to come roaring back as like a decentralized militia, and that all of these countries are going to be squabbling over how they control Syria.
Yeah,
the key to is HTS setting up some sort of command and control of the country, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think there's three scenarios, which you've actually just beautifully outlined. So,
no, sorry.
The first one is, of course, I think HTS ruling, but then ruling in a way that I think is their actions don't match their words, right? Like a toxic relationship when they say, I'm going to do one thing, and then they do another. That's the sort of first bad scenario. Right. And then the second bad scenario, I think, is civil war. And John, you mentioned this the other night. Syria is one of the most diverse countries in terms of sort of ethnic groups, in terms of geographies, in terms of, just the access to resources and all the sort of different interests that are there. So I think the civil war, I think, is
on the back of an envelope by European powers.
Quite literally.
The whole area was just like, that'll do, off we go into the sunset.
Yes, let's go have some more whiskey.
Jamming people together who don't agree with each other.
That's right. And so I think that's the second bad scenario in terms of, ongoing civil war that's going to be drawing in more regional powers, like different players, but they're still squabbling. And then I think the third one is, and I wonder whether this is going to come into fruition, is if something like some country like Qatar or some kind of regional mediator is able to step in, not the UN probably because they're completely distracted, and able to sort of support ongoing mediation or ongoing sort of support for the government formation and then governance of the country. Those are sort of three scenarios that I see. Two of them not great. The one, of course, the last one is that we hope that Al-Jilani is going to stick to his word and actually be able to effectively rule the country like he did.
And JD.
Yeah. I mean, spot on. Like, part of it is just potentially just ratifying the status quo, which is that there are just different chunks of the country. Like right now, US 900 troops working with the Syrian Democratic Forces, which are mostly Kurdish-led, like they control like a third of the country, which has got to be one of the greatest all-time ROI for a US military presence, like a third of Syria from 900 troops. and you got to wonder what the benefit of pulling those 900 troops out would be. It would probably make it easier for Turkey to bomb them harder, which just risks destabilizing the entire country. The other interesting thing is that there are around 10,000 ISIS prisoners held in that US Kurdish area.
Mm.
And these are like, hardened nutbags. Turkey doesn't like ISIS any more than the US does. And so it has to think, by pushing hard on this area, do you really want to risk, a breakout from that prison, a regrouping, and even more destabilized neighbors right across the border? So I think, a lot depends on what Turkey does. I think a lot, though, really still depends on what Jilani does and the extent to which he's able to get the other factions to buy in. By all accounts, he's been a pretty effective diplomat. Like, he was reaching out to these other groups well in advance of the offensive.
Yep.
And by all accounts, with a couple of spectacular exceptions, the dialogue has been pretty functional and open, and there is something there which I am skeptical will lead to, a long-term stable plurilateral Syria, but it's a possibility that there is dialogue there. Okay. So much though, like, we talk about these big factions, there's like, Jilani has spent years purging more radical voices from his own group. And
love that for him.
Yeah. And so that, like, he's got this, it's almost like he's had comms training. Everything he says is like so perfect from the perspective of, like, UN bureaucrats or like Western analysts. It's just like, wow, he's going to protect minorities and he's going to build a Syria for all. And he's putting out all these orders. He said, like, there was one out there saying, don't put pictures of Jilani on cars and posters. There's another one saying HTS members are not allowed to interfere with what women wear because personal freedoms are now guaranteed.
Leopard print for all.
So it's like, so on the one hand, he's saying all this stuff. But on the other hand, like, in the Telegram, in the HTS Telegram chats, when they first took Aleppo, they were like, Well, and then they took the major mosque in Damascus, which is like from the 8th century. And they're like, next we're taking Al-Aqsa. And then we're taking,
oh my gosh.
And then we're taking the major one in Saudi Arabia. So you've got like, still got radicals in there who just see this as step one to a broader Islamist project.
I want to talk more about this. I think this is interesting. Helen, you mentioned leopards. Can a leopard change its spots? Because I, like this guy has been, he was radicalized in one of those prisons in, was it in
Iraq.
Afghanistan or
Iraq. Yeah, Iraq. Yeah.
Radicalized there. And he's self-proclaimed to gone through a self-moderation process. Now, let's be serious. Like he's named Al-Jilani, I gather, because he's from the Golan Heights. Al-Golani, technically, right? I think I've read that somewhere. So he's in an area where Israel has been occupying that part of Syria, and it's Syria under international law for a long time. So where he's from, there's a lot of people who don't like Israel, right? He has been radicalized in an Iraqi prison. He was Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
He has now had massive success, and he's got a lot of power. And as JD rightly mentions, his ranks are full of folks who might be like, yeah, the boss is saying all this kind of nice stuff, but he's just being smart to kind of, you know, not get us bombed by everybody and their grandfather. What, honestly, I don't want to be skeptical, but I'm going to be. What hope do you honestly think that this guy's going to go in and govern, like, you know, oh, well, don't tell women what they can wear. You know, we're going to protect Christian groups. We're going to, like, let's be serious. Like, history tells us that he may talk a big game, but you know, bide his time and then it's going to go back to the same old. Tell me why I'm wrong. Tell me why I'm being a cynic.
Well, one, I mean, I'm extremely cynical as well. It's very hard to see how someone with his background, like getting radicalized during the second Intifada, fighting in Iraq, getting dumped in a US
prison.
This stuff
is like bloodline deep through centuries, right?
Yeah. And he was on, you know, first names basis with Al-Zawahiri, however you say him, the sort of Al-Qaeda chief there for a while. And people have been speculating about what is really going on with him ever since the high profile breakup between him and Al-Qaeda around 2016. At first it seemed like a mutual thing, like they'd gone to a media unconscious coupling. Like they had basically mutually decided, you know what, this is not working. And it seemed very performative. And there were people saying, look, and then they changed their name twice to end up at HTS. So they removed like Islamist branding from their name. Removed any formal associations. Very publicly, very performative.
Do you think
from
that's
Al-Qaeda.
Like Turkey? Do you think that's like Turkey's influence, being like, "Hey, like we can help you here, but you have to give us some like diplomatic and like plausible deniability. You have to at least pretend to moderate if we're going to be shipping you arms and like backing you." Is that otherwise?
I got the sense that the Turkish link has come later, and it hasn't been so obvious. I think Turkey has functional channels with them, but it's not like full-on backing, like, for example, Iran and Hezbollah or whatever, in the same way.
No, right.
At first it was this very performative public breakup, and the sense was they're just doing this to better free up Al-Jalani's hand to continue his project in Syria without getting bombed, without getting sanctioned, and that was it. But then real differences did start to emerge.
That kind of says that, like, the war against Al-Qaeda and ISIS works, because people are like, well, if I want a future and if we want to actually be a credible force beyond like the next couple of years and not get bombed the hell to wherever, we've got to kind of disassociate ourselves a bit.
I mean, but the security gurus used to have this same debate regarding cartels in Mexico. And I think one of the conclusions was that attacking these big groups, having a militarized approach, it just splintered them and made it even worse because they're fighting each other. Like,
interesting.
No one group was able to threaten as much, but it just made the whole scene more chaotic. But yeah, in this case, real differences did start to emerge. They started fighting each other. And HTS has taken on Al-Qaeda every time they've sort of had units emerge in their turf. And I think, mate, from what I can tell, it's a genuine ideological and theological split that's emerged. You would describe Al-Qaeda as a Salafi form of jihadism, and you would describe HTS as a political form of jihadism. The Salafis, they derive everything from their theology, and they're like, this is what the Quran says, so we're just going to go all in and Allah will back us up. And it's kind of a little divorced from the realities of on the ground, right? Which leads to all kinds of strange decisions, right, from a secular point of view. HTS, they're very much like, that's our inspiration and our North Star, but it's incumbent on us to use our
the
brands
vibe of
to,
the thing.
To, well, yeah, and anchor it in the political realities. And so what that means is right now, they don't have anywhere near the forces, maybe 25, maybe 40,000, you know, troops, you'd call them. And that's nowhere near enough to even hold the turf they've conquered, let alone the rest of the country. Right. So the reality of that political jihadism is to say we cannot further our project unless we do so in some kind of partnership with all these other factions that don't share our vision. And so it's a little more smart, but I think for those of us watching from abroad, it's also just more gray. Like we're used to like, I don't know, you know, Al-Qaeda bad and, you know, and like, I don't know,
ISIS
some other
bad.
Group good. Yeah, whatever. This, like, you know, there's a $10 million bounty on this guy's head because he denies any involvement, but HTS were, responsible for terrorist attacks, under the Assad regime in like 2017, right? And you can still see the tweet about it from the US embassy in Damascus, which is so strange. But like, you know, there are atrocities that you can trace back to this group, which he says he was not involved in and he rejected. But yeah, to circle back to your original question, like, is it plausible? Is it believable? I mean, you know, I want to believe it. But I think we're also in this world now where it's no longer black or white. I think we're seeing the emergence of a new type of movement, an Islamist technocracy, you know, online driver's licenses and services and moving to a free market economy, dealing with the UN and Western media. And we're just going to have to wrap our heads around that, which is going
to
be
hard. John, I think to that point, what's in it for him? I think prosperity for the country, right? And
so that's what I was
going to
say. Shouldn't we, like, as the we being, like, you know, every country that wants Syria to be back on its feet and have, you know, stability, shouldn't, you know, America, the UK, the EU, the Saudis, the Jordanians, the Israelis, even the Turks, shouldn't they be going like, okay, let's absolutely shower this guy in all the trappings of what being a head of state looks like. Like, bring him into the community, show him that, like, you can be a legit leader of a country, a serious country, a great old historic country with, like, lots of great things about it. We will make you that person. We'll invite you to the tables. You'll be at these meetings. Otherwise, there's always going to be this other, I mean, like, a devil on his shoulder is a bit dramatic, but, like, he's going to have that, the voices from people in his ranks. Hey, we've got to be more theocratic. We've got to do more of this. We've got to do more of that. Or, you know, maybe less dramatically, he will just get chewed up by the real politic of Turkey trying to dominate the region, Iran trying to re-dominate the region, Israel trying to dominate the region, and he'll just kind of get chewed up and spat out. Shouldn't the US be, like, rushing to embrace this guy?
Well, I mean, absolutely, right? I think the US and the region should be rushing to embrace this guy.
But then they've got a $10 million bounty on his head, so.
Well, there's
the
debate.
They can change that.
Blinken should meet with him and cut his throat and ride off into the sunset with $10
million. Till Los Carlos.
Not be like the person who tipped off the Luigi Mangione killing, you know, the one who called
the
into
McDonald's
the wrong
guy.
Yeah, the McDonald's person who called into the wrong.
Imagine that, just like between off a Happy Meal and a McFlurry, just calling in that tip.
I know, but calling the wrong one, calling 911 instead of the FBI one, so they didn't even get the collection. They didn't even get the bounty.
Oh, no.
I know, such a story of America.
That's like buying a lottery ticket and then putting it through the wash. My God.
I know.
So you guys have just sort of touched on the big question, which is whether the US, the UK, and others will remove the terrorist listing. And by all accounts, that debate has already started in DC. Yeah. The question, so it seems like an obvious, that is a real goal to move towards. But the question is, at what price? And there's a whole bunch of conditions that the US is going to want to put in place to hand over that massive dangling carrot of international recognition, sanctions removal, and then flooding in of aid and investment and re-engaging with the world. And those carrots, some of them will be, you have said you're not going to persecute minorities, Druze, Alawites, Christians. Like, if you start to do that, game over. You have said, you know, you're going to treat women with respect. If you don't do that, game over. So there are a couple of things like that. Another one is Israel, you know, like, likewise, he said, you said Israel is not an enemy. You just were in this to kick Iran out, kick Hezbollah out, kick Russia out. If you start shit with Israel again, then we're going to have to pull this out. Ditto chemical weapons. like they're going to find them somewhere. And I think the US price is going to be, if you find them, you report them straight away. You destroy them. Like, you don't like, use them as leverage. So like, there's going to be a whole range of, prices that the US wants to put in there, before, it makes itself comfortable to remove that terrorist listing. And by the way, it's also just a reminder that, I mean, sometimes terrorist listings are just obvious. Like, you know, if you're beheading Coptic Christians on a beach somewhere, you need to be brought in and, held to account. Sometimes though, there's a political element, and you can see that, potentially here that it's the same guy and the same group. And all of a sudden we're talking about saying, maybe they're not terrorists. And in fact, the Russians and the Iranians, if you were looking for a very, very clear sense of how much leverage they've lost, they went within 24 hours from calling HTS and others terrorists to calling them the opposition. All the state media, all the official statements, they're calling them the opposition all of a sudden. Because the reality is they need their, you know, their thumbs up to be able to protect whatever interests they've got left, particularly the Russians with those bases. They're not going to let you keep them if you're still running around calling them terrorists. So, yeah, that's going to be fun to watch that Washington debate. Helen?
Yeah, and it also depends. I mean, there are so many moving parts of this, what the Trump administration's approach to this will be, right? So whatever sort of designation they get under this current administration, that might be up for review. But I think overall, there's a lot of leverage at the international community within the region, internationally, within sort of like the big power competition can exert right now, because these folks really need international regional support, right? They've got a lot of extractive industries that they can sort of ship off and sell. I think this country has been under 10 years now of before the civil war, things went great in Syria, right? So I think the country economically needs a bit of a leg up. So there's incentive there for HTS and Al Jilani and co. to be able to sort of really ingratiate themselves in the region and bring peace and prosperity to their country and their civilians. So I think there's probably, you know, for me, I'm an optimist. I think that there is going to be some element of kind of, I don't know what the best word, just sort of like the settling of the dust of the current sort of internet, you know, political factions in fighting. But I think overall, with enough regional support, there's going to be a good trajectory for Syria. Famous last words, you heard it here first.
Well, thanks, yes, Ian. I mean, Ian Bremmer.
Yeah, no, I'm not, exactly.
I'm not going to shoot that down.
Hey, John, Helen just mentioned the magic word, which is Trump, and like, what's he going to do? And he put that tweet out, right? Sort of say, and it was like, it's interesting to see him just tweet his thoughts in live time. He basically said, interesting, you know, Russia's weak, Iran's weak. They like threw Assad under the bus. And basically he said, let's not get involved, let it play out. And I can totally understand that. It's like this bewildering random mix of like ancient hatreds and resentments and, you know, theological intricacies. And it's like, you know what, like there is no direct threat to the United States. Who cares? And I can totally get that. I guess for there to continue to be no direct threat to the United States, you need things to play out within certain guardrails. And that includes, for example, the not having the entire collapse of that third of the country that your allies control. And that means not letting ISIS regroup and then, you know, kidnapping and, beheading US citizens and terrorizing the region. So I could totally understand how you want to like not get involved. And I don't know whether there's need for the US to get any more involved than what it is. But when you start yoinking out the 900 troops, which have a massive deterrent effect for all the others in the area there and whatever logistical and intel support they're providing those Kurdish troops, when you pull that out, you can all of a sudden see the thing emerge that you confidently said was no longer there and didn't require your presence anymore, which in this case is ISIS or something like that.
I think there's zero chance that Trump doesn't get pulled into the Middle East in his 4 years. I just think it's impossible. He'll have too many competing voices saying, you know, A, we could have a ton of influence for a very low cost, the classic one. I mean, as you said, Syria, 900 troops in Syria and a lot of, and maybe a few weapons to the Kurds, and you get a lot of influence.
Yeah.
The Saudis will be saying, hey, we've noticed this kind of stuff. We're friends now. You've got Trump Tower in Riyadh or wherever it is that they announced yesterday.
Jeddah,
can you just help? Yeah, can you just help us out with X, Y, Z? The Israelis will be doing the same thing. I just don't see how the U.S. and even J.D. Vance tweeted when he said, you know, first, President Trump is correct that we don't have any dog in this fight. But also, I think that, you know, it's naive to say that I think he said that it's naive to say that the HTS, you know, Islamist group, won't start prosecuting Christians. What happens if they do start prosecuting Christians? Mm. Trump is the Christian nationalist president of the US. There's going to be a ton of folks in his ear going, oi, we've got to go protect these people. So there's just so many different things that I just can't see a world. In a way, it'd be amazing if Trump does manage to not involve America and to kind of withdraw, but I just don't see that happening. Before we wrap up, I want to zoom out a bit and talk about maybe three or four countries and where how they view this. So obviously Israel, Helen, you served in Israel, so you have plenty of thoughts on that. I think Turkey's super fascinating on this one. And then Iran, because Iran, in the space of like, well, let's be generous, in the space of about a year, they've gone from having everything just like they want it pretty much, with proxies all over the place and, you know, a kind of almost like, you know, you speak of the UK and the US having the nuclear trident, where it's like, oh, if you bomb us, we can attack you from the sea, the land, and the and the air. They had the, if you attack us, we can attack you from Lebanon, from Gaza, from Yemen. Yeah. Now they've got maybe Yemen, but not that. They probably don't have, they just certainly don't have Hamas anymore, and Hezbollah's massively weakened. So what do you think? Do you think the Ayatollah's like looking at his, looking out going like, my work, my beautiful work, it's all gone. I shouldn't laugh. It's horrible, but you know, it's also good that that's Iran's been stuck to it.
Are we starting with Iran? We're going to
You start wherever you want. I'm just talking, you know, talking nonsense as per usual.
I mean, the Ayatollah is not a spring chicken, otherwise he's probably okay to run for US politics. No, but seriously, I think he's, the country is looking probably the most, I think, weakened in terms of the IRGC's influence than it has for a generation.
And that's this the, is kind that's of the Revolutionary when, Guard, kind of like the military, quasi-military political group that essentially runs the Iranian state, as it were.
Exactly, exactly. And I think in some ways this is sort of when the most, you know, at risk of the, you know, big, bold acts of destabilizing is,
yes,
you know, when people are sort of, organizations are dying or weakening, they have their last kind of push to make their mark in the world. And so I'm kind of watching for that to happen in Iran, right? It's a sort of objective fact that the country has been massively weakened, not just within Iran, but also with the proxies around the region, including Syria and Iraq, by the way.
Is it possible that we could be having this conversation about Iran and being like, how did it fall down so quickly? Was like, is that possible?
I don't think so, because I think the IRGC has actually got a lot of forces across the country, and it's got some pretty strong military.
So it's just their external
every region
kind of arms that have been hollowed out and kind of cut off, rather than an internal state.
Right, exactly.
I would just add as well that Iran is so much more homogenous. It's like overwhelmingly majority ethnic Persian, Farsi-speaking, Shiite. So there's like, of course, there's lots of shades there in terms of their specific theology and ideology. I think for Iran, it's more a question of whether that relatively homogenous, unified population just gets so angry with their regime because of how shit things are getting. This is like a proud people with thousands of years of history, brilliant thinkers, you know. So, like, I think it's more a question of whether that very binary.
It's hard to make that authoritarian argument. Yeah, it's hard to make that authoritarian argument that, like, well, you may not like everything about us, but we're making your life better year on year. Like, that's what China has always said about the Chinese people.
But they're not Iran making their lives better, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Iran can't do that. And I think there's now talks of thinking, you know,
it might have been able to say recently, hey, we've got Israel in a box and they're an existential threat to us. But they can't even say that anymore.
Exactly. And pivoting to Israel, using that.
Yeah,
I mean,
go ahead.
I think, look, Israel is, you know, they famously sort of held onto the Golan Heights after pushing back the Syrians in, I think, the 67 conflict. So that was a long time because it was a strategic point for them. And if you've ever been to the Golan Heights, it's very high up. It's a plateau, basically. And from
right,
Syrian
right there
Golan
in the name.
Heights. Pardon?
It's right there in the name.
You never knew. Anyway, for those who are playing back home, it's very high up. You can overlook all of Israel and sort of look down. I think strategically that is why the Israelis and the IDF have kind of so strongly held on to the territory, because for them it's a strategic, and, you know, the tanks literally came rolling in from Syria, so there's a lot of trauma there for the IDF. But also as a strategic strong point for them to hold on to that higher ground. So I don't think Israel has any appetite to push beyond the existing sort of Israel control of Golan Heights, which, you know, the US unilaterally recognized under the first Trump administration. What they're watching is that they Assad for them was like a devil, but a devil that they knew. So right now, what they don't want is to have ISIS or sort of the more Islamist and more extremist versions of, you know, whatever the rebel groups or the extremist factions of the rebel groups at the border, challenging them and opening up another front.
On their border, literally on their border.
Literally on their border, right? Where on the one side, there's, you know, wineries in Israel, Golan Heights, and literally you can sit from the wineries and watch the Syrian Golan Heights and watch the fighting going on there. That was one very clear, crazy memory I remember from my time there. But, you know, in terms of what Israel's been doing in the last 10 years, they've been trying to form these relationships with the Syrian rebel forces this whole time. So I think this is like no longer a secret, but they had been getting Syrian rebel fighters across the border to treat them in Israeli hospitals and then shipping them back to the other side. And we had done a visit, you know, as part of the embassy there to go and visit Syrian rebel fighters. So that relationship, I think, for the Israelis, they are trying to ensure that they have a friend in Damascus. They're not going to be besties, but I think that they're okay for now, and they're hoping that things don't get worse.
They've also taken pretty dramatic steps to cripple any kind of, you know, military apparatus that could have fallen into the hands of an ISIS or an Al-Qaeda or a kind of rebel group. They bombed Assad's navy, took out his air force. They say they're hitting chemical weapons stores all over the place.
Yeah.
But, which, you know, conversely, will make, if Syria is a, if HTS is able to kind of wrap their hands around Syria and kind of govern, it will make them a lot weaker in terms of being able to fight some of those groups. So there's kind of a give and take there. Like, it's, I guess Israel's kind of going, well, the bigger risk to us is that they don't get their hands around Syria and the rebels, and, well, not the rebels, the militants get this stuff.
But also embolden some of those hardliners in HTS who already saw Israel as the great enemy. And for them, they'll point to all these, you know, ruined ships and tanks. Like, we told you, these guys.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to me how much Israel chose to play into that. But at the same time, it's interesting to me how much Israel has got dunked on for that by neighbors and the international media. Not surprising, interesting, compared to what Turkey has been doing in northern Syria, like bombing Kurds for the last decade and controlling like a fifth of the country, like doing more than what Israel has done, but no one says a peep. So I think it's interesting to me how that plays into the Israeli narrative of, oh, you're just ganging up on us because we're the world's one Jewish state.
But Netanyahu had politically no choice. He had to strike first. He and his administration had been asleep at the wheel for the Hamas attacks. There is absolutely no way they could have been like, oh, well, we just wanted to see how it played out. It played out badly, right?
Whoops.
Miss the red flags.
Exactly. Let's wrap up by just talking about Turkey, JD. You mentioned it there, like the Kurdish people. I had a Kurdish friend in London who would always just say, like, well, no one cares about us. We are the forgotten people between Iraq, between Turkey, between, like, we are the kind of, I remember Christopher Hitchens, the kind of, you know, public firebrand intellectual, the UK guy, that was his big, he died of cancer, sadly, but his big thing, his big reason to support the Iraq war, and well beyond it being unpopular to do so, he kept supporting the Iraq war and that because he said that the Kurdish people were being massacred and no one cares about them. That's still the case, right? But it's just Turkey doing maybe not the massacring, but the bombing and the fighting, and they are
pretty brutal bombing, and like they've been wiping out, you know, water installations, power plants, like leaving 2 million Kurds like without, you know, basic humanitarian services. And I mean, they, you know, their argument is that these groups are essentially, you know, renamed versions of the PKK, right? The Kurdish Workers Party. That's a listed terrorist group that has carried out terrorist attacks on civilians. It is a question for the ages why there are no campus protests for the Kurds, why it's not a fashionable cause, why there are no, you know, viral Instagram pics that everyone puts on their feed. Like, don't forget Rafah was one that went around the world. There's never been anything like that for the Kurds. And that maybe takes us into a murky conversation about the reasons why. And you know, Israel and its supporters would say it's because it's not Jewish people doing the bombing. It's others. And so, like, it gets into an argument about anti-Semitism and everything. The Kurds had a pretty, they've got an autonomous region in, they effectively control a big chunk of Syria, but also autonomous Kurdistan and Iraq. So, I mean, there is something building there. They have pretty close ties with the US in parts, with Israel in parts. Like, there's rumors that Mossad have launched some of their espionage against Iran from Kurdish-held territory. They have friends, they have turf, they have an interesting track record of effective governance. There's something there, but there is a long history with the Turks, who have long memories. And Erdogan has a big ego, and it's hard to see him letting up on this.
And he is in, like, he is maybe not ascendant, but he is locked in power, and he's made deals with the Turkish nationalists that, you know, he's not going to give that fight up. And Helen, I don't know how you see it, but I kind of, you know, Iran is the big loser here, and Turkey is the big winner from this Syria stuff. Like, Turkey will basically, I think, control, if not a puppet government, something pretty similar in Syria. And if there was one thing arguably stopping Turkey from really putting the Kurds to the sword, it was probably that they didn't want to get too far involved in the civil war in Syria. They didn't want to go too far, you know, beyond the borders. They didn't want to have Turkish troops on the ground in those areas. They had Russia was obviously involved in it, so like they needed to talk to Russia every time they tried to push the Kurds back and get the kind of Putin's implicit consent. Now they're going to be able to do it over a long period of time, much more systematically, because they're going to control Damascus, or at least have heavy influence in Damascus. Am I wrong, or am I talking out of my hat?
I think you're maybe talking out of your hat.
I love that. That's what we want.
Love that expression. You know, I don't think that Turkey is going to be looking to get too involved, apart from sort of ensuring that the Kurds don't have their own autonomous region. That's always been their strategic goal, to sort of prevent the sort of southern and the northern Turkish forces from joining forces. They'll be able to push back on them. So as long as they're able to keep that buffer, Turkey has a lot of their own problems to figure out domestically, right? I don't think the economy is looking flash hot either, and I think there's a lot of other issues that are going to be keeping them busy. So in sum, I don't think that, you know, they're going to be looking to Damascus as another fight. I think they've won this round, Ottomans versus Persians, ding, 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 goes for the Ottomans. But let's see what happens going forward. There's going to be a lot more things happening in Syria that they just can't afford to weigh into.
JD, do you have any thoughts on that? I mean, I think you're kind of joking there, Helen, with Ottomans versus Persians, but I think Erdogan kind of sees himself as
absolutely. These ancient civilizations all see themselves like that, Chinese as well, right? And so it's sort of Putin, this is the like way the, that
Putin is the kind of he sees Russian himself as
the rightful heir to an empire that his predecessors fumbled. Absolutely. I mean, the Turks have dozens of military bases along northern Syria. They have tanks, they have troops in there, as well as supporting these groups. Mm-hmm. They control an area something like 300 times the size of the Golan Heights that that Israel has now fully taken. I find it fascinating that essentially they are doing the exact same thing as Israel, so invading a neighbor out of a claimed sense of protecting themselves against terrorists. But no one really cares about Turkey doing it. I don't know. I find that interesting. But I mean, Erdogan has noticed. He can do this stuff and gets zero pushback. And so I don't see why he would stop. I mean, he's on, like, Syria used to be part of the Ottoman Empire. Mm-hmm. I think Erdogan sees this as a return to the natural state of things with the Turks as a, you know, rightful regional hegemon running the block. And that block now includes Syria.
And a NATO member too, so has the protection of kind of legitimacy in the West. And I mean I agree, it's good to be Erdogan right now, I think he probably couldn't believe his luck, as you kind of started the podcast off saying, like, he was like, oh, we'll probably just push a little bit into, oh my god, we got Aleppo, oh my god, Assad's gone, and Russia's gone as well, so there's nothing stopping us now.
Well, and I think the title of our upcoming briefing, which is probably like the Friday the 13th that we're releasing in a few hours, the title is something along the lines of why Erdogan just had the best week of his life. And it dives into that. It's kind of great. Shocking. Yeah.
All right, folks. Well, that might be a good place to leave it. Thank you very much for your time. I think it was a fascinating conversation. Helen, thank you.
Thank you.
Jeremy, getting up early, thank you very much.
Thanks, team. That was fun. Let's do it again sometime.
Definitely.
Sorry, just some distracting background noise.
You're
here.
Good. If you want to pause for a second, I can edit this. So you're good.
I'll just take a deep breath because it's a very annoying noise.
You're good.
So annoying.
you can explain it if you want.
any mums and dads out there, like, there are just certain whingy noises that just make your blood boil. And I can just hear one just absolutely cooking out there. My blood is boiling. Maybe it was the talk about Ian Bremmer that was making my blood boil. It's hard to pinpoint.